يقولون سلام سلام ولا هنا سلام.
You're listening to Middle East Analysis, a podcast series from the Catholic Bishops' Conference of England and Wales. Well, with Christmas fast approaching, it's time for another Middle East analysis. And this Middle East analysis will most probably take us through the whole season. So we want to set very much a Christmas tone to this particular conversation. To do this, I'm joined by Dr. Harry Hagopian, who is the Bishop's Consultant on the MENA region, the Middle East North Africa region. And Harry, if you don't mind, could I just start by offering, on behalf of the Bishops' Conference, our condolences after the death of your mum? Because I know obviously a lot has passed, and a lot has passed for you personally. So obviously you're in our thoughts and prayers.
Thank you very much, James. I appreciate that.
Now, you know, we're 3 weeks into Advent. We're not far from Christmas. We're going to hone in a bit on the Christian communities. But to start with, let's talk a little bit about the situation in the region at the moment, Harry.
Well, it's interesting, James, because we are almost 1 year. It's the first anniversary of the start of the MENA uprisings. As your listeners would know, it started in Tunisia and then moved forward into Egypt, into Libya, Syria, Yemen, and many other countries. And during this 1 year, there are lots of things that have happened, a lot of them unpredictable, and a lot of them will still be unpredictable as we go into the next year. But there are 5 points that I have learned as I've observed and studied the region and as I've met people across this whole MENA region. And I call them the 5 myths, things that we thought at the beginning were true, and that during the course of this year, we have found out that they're not so true, actually. The first one is that we thought that this is one uprising by all the Arab masses across the one region, Middle East, North Africa, in order to rid themselves of oppression and totalitarian regimes and introduce dignity and citizenship's rights into their lives. What we've learned is that no, actually, each country has its own particularities, its own specificities, its own requirements, and therefore what might have happened in Tunisia does not happen in the same way in Egypt, in Libya, in Syria, and in other countries. The other thing we thought about is that this whole thing was basically owned by the younger generations, what was known as the Facebook generation. Well, the truth is that the Facebook generation and the young people were the ones who actually started this whole uprising in this vast region. And in a sense, the way they got away with it is very interesting, James, because the Middle East and North Africa basically is a security box with intelligence services coming out of every room. So how come they didn't predict this happening and they didn't come and crush it or nip it in the bud before it happened? The reason is specifically, in my opinion, because it was started by young people who were not on the radar of those intelligence services and security people, and therefore they suddenly went into the public squares, they suddenly started chanting slogans, they applied pressure, and the rest is history in terms of the start of those uprisings. The reason why it was pretty much more successful in Tunisia and much quicker in Egypt, the most important country within the Middle East and North Africa, it didn't take that many days for President Mubarak to leave office. Now, why is it that it happened relatively quickly in those two countries and we are seeing so much bloodletting and so much suffering in other countries like Syria and Yemen, which do not have the historicity or the structures of a country like Egypt? The reason, amongst other things, is not only because people are pretending to know what's happening on Facebook and they're impersonating those young generations who are rising up against the regimes, but also because the regimes are learning from the experiences that happened a year back and are therefore preparing themselves for what is possibly going to come into their own countries, either in terms of pretending to introduce reforms or introducing real reforms and constitutional amendments of a limited nature, or alternatively, coming down with a very, very hard cracking a stick, trying to get everybody to basically go back to their houses and stop demonstrating in the streets. But what is true is that what started as Facebook generation has in fact been co-opted by other interested parties and vested interests, such as the regimes, such as parties that had been there and organized for years. So this is the second myth as far as the MENA region is concerned. The third one is we thought, oh, well, with everything happening there, it disproves the fact that Palestine is the hub of the Middle East. Well, I beg to disagree with that, because as you would see in most demonstrations across the whole region, whether in Yemen, whether in Syria, whether in Egypt, anywhere, you will see always the Palestinian component there. You will always see a few Palestinian flags. You will always see people chanting some slogans which support Palestinian self-determination. And I believe that we are actually missing a huge, huge opportunity at the moment to resolve the Israeli-Palestinian conflict by showing flexibility, goodwill, and compromise by the two parties, namely Israel and the Palestinian Authority, because if we do that, first of all, we spare the Palestinians all the suffering they've been having for so many decades. But also, if you manage to sort out and resolve the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, you will actually contribute to the peacemaking of the whole region. So that's the third myth I would add. The fourth one is we in the West, through our colonial history, through our interests, through our money, through our contacts, we thought that we could actually shape the destiny of the Arab world, of the MENA region.
Have we not learned that we can't do that yet?
Well, apparently not, because we are all prone to repeating the same mistakes. And what has happened is that now the West is realizing that we cannot actually, we can influence, we can provide support, we can be there when asked to be there. Yes, of course, we have our own interests. We have the oil, we have the strategic interests, we have the military interests, but we can no longer expect this region to basically just stand up, say yes, sir, no, sir, sit down and follow orders coming from the West. That has also gone. And the fifth and last myth that has been expunged, in my opinion, during this 1 year, is that the Islamists are poised to rule across the region, and therefore it's going to be a radical Islamist apocalyptic period for the region, which is going to cast its shadows long and wide across the region. That, in my opinion, is also a myth, James.
But in light of that last point you made, I mean, you look at Tahrir Square, so much the icon in the early days, a year ago, as you say, also the focal point for a great deal of fighting amongst religions, we'd have to say as well. So is it really true that people aren't feeling threatened by a potentially extreme nature of Islam in these countries?
Of course they're feeling threatened by the extremist nature of Islam, because what has happened is we've had decades and decades of basically so-called secular, and it's not strictly secular, autocratic, oppressive regimes, which have basically thought instead of the citizen, acted instead of the citizen, and basically told the citizen what to do and what not to do. And we haven't had this effervescence, this awakening of Islam until recently. And what this 1 year has done is basically it has increased the influence that those parties which have an Islamic nature to them, it has helped bring them to prominence. Now, people might say, wow, that's worrying. Yes, in a sense, it might be worrying, and it might be worrying to the people who are used to the status quo. It might be worrying to the people who think that Islam is that bogey man at the end of a tunnel, and if we go anywhere near there, we're going to perish. Or we might think that, okay, what happens if Islam comes and the minorities' rights and the minorities' realities across all those countries where there are indigenous Christians will actually be compromised? Well, my answer to that is twofold. On the one hand, I would say that this is another form of Western colonialism. And let me explain why. I think that when we sit here and we say that Islam is going to mess up the region, that to me is a form of political intellectual colonialism, because we are therefore deciding on behalf of the people of the region that the electoral legitimacy of those parties is not appropriate to the region. And who are we to decide if those people decided that they wanted to vote in, as they did in Egypt, as they did in Morocco, as they did in Tunisia, they wanted to vote in people who are Islamic in nature, then who are we to tell them, no, you can't do it? But I would qualify that, James, with 2 points. I would say that I'm open to the idea, if we're talking about democracy, whatever that flawed concept means, because democracy is not in abstract terms, doesn't exist. It's relative. We pretend we have democracy in the West, where our democracy can also be quite fragile if and when it is pushed. So if we are thinking of good governance, if we're thinking of the rule of law, if we're thinking of citizenship rights, if we're thinking of dignity, and if we're thinking of economic rights, because at the end of the day, this is not only about politics, it's about economics. This is not only about citizenship rights, it's also about bread on the table for each man and woman in that region who do not have the money and for years and years have basically existed in poverty while their rulers have become richer and richer and richer. So in that sense, my qualifying provisos would be the following. If we're going to agree that some sort of Islamic nature is going to come out in the region, which could be cyclical, it could change again in 5-10 years' time, but that's what we are witnessing at the moment. The first thing, I think, is that the treatment of minorities in those countries would be a litmus test of whether those regimes, those new rulers, believe or subscribe to the idea of democracy and good governance. Will they be inclusive? Will they be able to provide to those people who do not necessarily share their beliefs equal political space, equal religious space, equal practical employment? Are they going to be a version of what is being known today as soft Islam, like Turkey, like Malaysia, like Indonesia? After all, today, in my opinion, Egypt is exactly where Indonesia was in 1998. And Indonesia today is one of the most modern, tolerant, majority Muslim countries. There are more Muslims in Malaysia and Indonesia than there are in the whole MENA region. And yet they seem to be getting on with their lives quite well in a tolerant way, respecting minorities much more than in other places. So is it going to be that litmus test of democracies, or is it going to be an oppression that is going to make life much more difficult for the Christian communities across the whole Middle East and North Africa? In the 19th century, Alex de Tocqueville said that democracy and minorities are two incompatible ideas. And it's very interesting because I actually think that if we manage to get the real essence of rule according to Islamic principles, the first thing that Islam teaches you is to treat minorities and those who do not share your faith well, protect them not in the sense of second-class citizens, but not aggress their rights, give them the political space in order to live decently? Or are they going to go into this puritanical, conservative, radical, Salafi kind of Islam, which believes women don't have rights, minorities don't have rights, nobody has rights except them? And in my opinion, what they teach is inimical with the teachings of the Prophet Muhammad anyway.
That's a very interesting point, Harry, and just I have limited personal experience in the MENA region. But one experience that I have had, without necessarily naming the particular republic, but, you know, hardline regime, very well known as being a very, very right-wing regime. But the people themselves, the academics that I spoke to and just others on the street, taxi drivers and others, were very much of that nature of Islam you've described, a far more tolerant, a far more hospitable and friendly. I saw a wonderful face of Islam, if that's how I am to take it.
Well, that wonderful face of Islam still does exist. If you go to different countries across the region, any country across the region, you look at the people in Syria, you look at the people in Iraq, you look at the people in Lebanon, you look at the people in Jordan, in Palestine, you go into Egypt, you go into Iran. In all those countries, you can see that the people actually get on well when left to their own devices. It's only when you have people coming from above, so-called rulers, so-called governors, so-called appointed religious leaders, coming and then playing politics with their peoples, that is when things get awry, and that's when things get back, that's when things get tense and polarized. And what I'm trying to say, and I know it's too much to put into a 5-minute, 10-minute podcast, what I'm trying to say is that of the five myths that I just related to you, I'm not saying that there aren't fears. I'm not saying that there aren't concerns. I'm not saying that there aren't possibilities where things could go wrong and where Christian communities and other minorities, for instance, take Iraq. I mean, half the Christian community has been decimated. It's no longer in the country. But there are other communities, minorities, the Mandaeans, the Sabaeans, the Baha'is, the Yazidis, all these people who have really borne the brunt of the so-called liberation of Iraq from autocracy, from Saddam Hussein, by instituting a government which has done nothing but foment intra-Muslim Shia-Sunni tensions, and which therefore has had its consequences upon the Christian and other minorities in Iraq. So my hope, my prayer is that we see the emergence of a more tolerant, inclusive form of Islam. If that is what is coming to the fore in the region, it is not our right as Westerners to recolonize the political and intellectual thought process of the Middle East and tell them you are wrong to elect those people. They have to make their own mistakes, they have to have their own experiences, and we have to be with them all the way, giving them support when necessary and drawing back when they want to go forward.
Well, on that note, Harry, obviously, seasonally, it's all eyes on Bethlehem in many ways. And so I'd like us to just finish the podcast by focusing in on the Christian communities of the region.
Let's do that, James. And interestingly enough, if you remember, we talked on one of our podcasts about a conference that took place at Lambeth that was chaired by the Archbishops of Canterbury and Westminster, our own Archbishop Vincent Nichols and Archbishop Rowan Williams. And that one specifically looked at the Christians of the Holy Land and what are their hopes, what are their fears. Only a few days ago, there was a motion tabled at the House of Lords by the Archbishop of Canterbury, Rowan Williams, to discuss the situation of Christians across the whole Middle East and North Africa. And what happened during that debate in the House of Lords, where about 30 to 35 peers, lords and ladies, spoke out, some of them very learnedly, very wisely, others just basically giving opinions, was to actually home in a little bit on those realities, the contradictions, the fears, the hopes. And then the message was, yes, we have to be watchful, we have to be vigilant, but it is not our place to tell others how to live their lives. What it is our place to do is to stand in solidarity with those Christians across the whole region, be prayerful with them, stand there and speak out with them whenever they're concerned, share their joys and celebrations as well. And what better way to share that joy and celebration than now that we're coming to the Christmas season, to the Feast of the Nativity, when the Word was made flesh, when our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ was born. And where was he born, James? He wasn't born in London or Sydney. He was born in Bethlehem, that little tiny town that now is not really too different from what the little town of Bethlehem was with the carol we sing for Christmas. And in a sense, the whole biblical narrative, the whole story unfolded in countries like Syria, like Egypt, like Iraq, like Israel, like Palestine. So our thoughts should be with them. Our prayers should be with them. We should be watchful as to what happens in the future with those communities in a region that is pretty much fragile and uncertain. I'm sure when we talk in January, we will introduce new elements and new developments into what's happening in the region. Look at Syria from one day to another. The number of deaths are mounting up, and we don't know which way the country is going yet. So just being prayerful and just saying he was born in order to save humankind, and we are here to give praise to that Lord.
I'd like you, Harry, because we haven't for quite some time, to offer up something of a Christmas message in Arabic, in a number of languages, entirely up to you. The floor is yours, but leave our listeners with something to take away for the season.
I'm not going to go into many languages. I'm not even going to do it in Armenian, which is my native language. I'm just going to do it in Arabic because the majority of the people in the MENA region speak in Arabic. And therefore, all I would say, أتمنى لكم جميعا عيد ميلاد مجيد وسنة مباركة ملؤها السلام والبركة. Which translated means, Merry Christmas to you, a Happy New Year, and may the new year be a year of hope and peace for all.
Which is beautiful and a little bit different from me, thinking you were talking still about Hosni Mubarak in Egypt. Harry, thank you ever so much, and we'll catch up in 2012, as it will be then, and talk perhaps a little bit about the Holy Land coordination, focusing in on Israel, Palestine, and of course the wider region.
That would be after the coordinating meeting, so there'll be a lot of food for thought, and a Merry Christmas to you as well, James.
Thanks ever so much, Harry.